So one of the more straightforward discourses the Buddha gives on working with thought includes a story about himself before he was awakened. I like all of the stories about the Buddha, a lot of us do, before he was enlightened, because, you know, he actually talks about his own struggles on the path, right? He doesn't just come in and say, I am the perfected one. Let me tell you how to do it, you poor, you know, unenlightened worldlings. But he says, you know, when I was still, you know, not yet liberated myself, not yet awakened, I practiced in this and that way. And there's a bunch of these that indicate different aspects of his practice. And the Buddha, you know, is a unique kind of practitioner, partly because he had teachers, but none of his teachers were fully awakened. None of his teachers could show him the path all the way to what he was seeking. So in the beginning of his practice, you know, he famously practices with two different teachers, Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta. And they're both apparently quite wise, you know, quite accomplished teachers. And they teach him two different very deep meditations, formless meditations. And that's helpful to him. Later on in his own teaching, he uses those. And immediately after his awakening, these two former teachers of his are the first people he thinks of to go to and tell them what he's learned. And he sees with his clairvoyance that they've both just recently passed away. And he's sad about that for their sake. So he has some teachers, but he has to figure out a lot on his own. And he has to figure out the basic meditation method that he's going to use on his own, right? He does this by remembering his childhood and a moment under a rose apple tree on a beautiful spring day where he connects with the relaxed, embodied, focused state of the first jhana, a much more embodied and pleasurable meditation state than the one he had learned with his teachers. So he has to find that out on his own. He figures out on his own how to work with fear, what we might call working with trauma, but he finds fear and dread recurringly arising for him. And so he goes to a place where he will, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, he goes to a place where he will have the opportunity to encounter that fear. And then he makes a plan for how to be with it in the body and stay with it through its cycle of activation and deactivation until it has settled. So he figures out all of these methods for working with the body and the mind that he found himself with. And then there's this one beautiful text. It's Majjhima Nikaya 19, so Middle Length Discourses 19. And it's usually translated Two Kinds of Thought. And in it, the Buddha essentially says, you know, before I was awakened, I noticed that I had different kinds of thinking. And I thought, what if I practice just categorizing my thoughts into two groups, the wholesome or skillful and the unwholesome or unskillful, right? And the word is kusala and akusala. You can translate kusala as wholesome or skillful, and akusala is the negation, unwholesome or unskillful. So he says, what about if I if I categorize all my thoughts as these two things. And so first, that's just the practice. Like, just name these things. And then he says, okay, so, you know, what am I actually looking for? So here's what the text says. Here's the words that he uses in English. He says, so I assigned sensual, malicious, and cruel thoughts to one class, and I assigned thoughts of renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness to the second class. So sensuality, maliciousness, and cruelty is one thing. Renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness is the other. Does anyone recognize this list, first of all? Renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness. What are these three things? Yeah, Lorraine, what are they?
I'll just go for it.
Uh-huh.
It's just getting beyond your ego and being present with what's going on and not grasping or going towards anything. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That is all of that is true. Generally speaking, that is true. But they're a formal list. So which formal list are they? Anybody know?
I think it's the opposite of the five fingers, the first three. Greed, the aversion, and also that three also appears in Parami, I think. I'm not sure. I remember renunciation.
Uh-huh. Not quite. They do map. They are the opposites, sort of the hindrances, and they're not sila. They're not part of the action limbs. They are the three aspects of right intention, samma sankappa, the second limb of the Eightfold Path. So right intention, and you might know, you might see somewhere that right intention is also sometimes translated as right thought. And I don't like the translation right thought. I like right intention. But it ties in here with the Buddha saying, I noticed I had three kinds of thoughts. And so what is an intention, right? An intention is a thought. It's a volitional thought. It's on purpose. And it points you toward qualities that are going to be helpful on the path. And the three unwholesome thoughts, you know, are the opposites of these three. So here's the text. I'll pull it up so we can see it for a moment. Text study night at satsang. So this is the Dvedha Vitaka Sutta. So Dvedha, two types, Vitaka, thought, Sutta, two types of thinking. And so here's his categories. I assigned sensual, malicious, and cruel thoughts to one class, renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness to the second. So renunciation as the opposite of sensuality, goodwill, the opposite of maliciousness, and harmlessness or non-harming, the opposite of cruelty. And so when he meditates, then he says, okay, so as I'm meditating, diligent, keen, and resolute, right? Good things to have. A sensual thought arose. And he's going to say the same thing for each of the three, sensual, malicious, and cruel. And then he thinks, this sensual thought has arisen in me. It leads to hurting myself, hurting others, and hurting both. It blocks wisdom. It's on the side of anguish and doesn't lead to extinguishment. And here's the important bit, or one of the important bits. When I reflected that it leads to hurting myself, the whole list, others and both, and blocking wisdom and anguish and not leading to extinguishment, it went away. So the practice here is, first there's the dividing of thoughts into thoughts that are wise intentions, renunciation, goodwill, harmlessness, and then thoughts that are not, that are unwise. And then when encountering the unwise versions of any of those, so unskillful sensual thoughts, that doesn't just mean sexual, by the way, although it can. It really means thoughts connected with the senses in a way that's going to cause harm. So that could be any kind of greed, any kind of wanting sensual contact, right? It could mean, you know, wanting to be so physically comfortable that I somehow, you know, that I stop caring about the environmental cost of my air conditioner, let's say. You know, I'm just committed to a certain kind of comfort, and I'm deluded or unwilling to see the implications of this, you know, particular kind of comfort. So it could be anything relating to grasping or wanting through the senses, and of course, sensual lust could be here in the way that it leads to harm, right? In the way that, and anything that can lead to harm. So the reflection is, okay, I see it for what it is. I see it as unwholesome. And then I reflect on the results of that. Because remember that intention is just a thought, or just a thought with an energy. The way that it matters is that it unfolds as action. We can think of the sequence of the Eightfold Path in this, right? There's right view, right intention, and then right speech, action, and livelihood. And so taken in order, there's a way that my worldview conditions or gives rise to certain kinds of thinking, certain kinds of intentions. And then those intentions, wholesome or unwholesome, give rise to certain kinds of actions, certain kinds of speech, certain kinds of actions, certain kinds of livelihood, which is larger actions in the world. And so he's making this connection, right? I see that there's thoughts that are unwholesome. I see that they could give rise to harm for myself or others or both, or non-wisdom, you know, anguish, non-extinguishment. It's important to know that the thought itself doesn't automatically give rise to harm. The Buddha's often more literal than that. It's really the thought could give rise to harm for myself or others if it plays out as speech, action, or livelihood, right? Then, so it's the seed for the ethical limbs, but it's not itself an ethical limb, right? It's not by itself unethical to have an unwholesome thought. That would be damning. You know, we would all be sunk if that were the case. It's the Buddha understands that thinking is not something that we do volitionally, mostly, and that thoughts are the echo of past conditions, and they're the echo of the culture around us. You know, it's if I have a thought that's harmful, you know, toward another person, it's very likely that that thought was conditioned by something around me. You know, human beings by nature are loving, tend to be loving. You know, no infant is murderous, right? People learn cruelty. People learn insults. Infants don't insult. You know, toddlers don't insult you. They learn to insult you later on. My kid caused a marvelous ruckus a couple weeks ago when he was mad, and he shouted at me. He said, "You bearded baby!" And I was like, you know, and his mama and another mama were in the other room, and they were just like, they were trying to not laugh out loud, you know, because we were having a serious boundary moment, you know, but like, you know, but it was a great insult, actually, like, "You bearded baby." And, you know, and so like, kids have to learn. Kids learn how to insult. And some of them get really good at it, of course, and some don't. But it's not innate, right, to the species, you know, to the animal. And that means that it's, you know, in a certain way, not your fault. You're still responsible for what you say, but it's not your fault in that way, right? Once you understand that a thing is unwholesome, however, right, you have a responsibility then, if you have ethics, to restrain unwholesome thought, unwholesome intention, before it turns into speech or action or livelihood. And so the first of the, it's so important that the first of the wise intentions is renunciation, right? Is letting go. Because one of the first things you do when you notice unwholesome or unskillful qualities arising is you work to set them down, right? This is going to come back in the first limb of the meditative sequence, the limb of right effort, where the instruction is that if there are wholesome states present, to nurture them, right, and strengthen them. And if there are wholesome states not present, to invoke them and invite them and train in them. But if there are unwholesome states present, to work to diminish them and stop them. And if there are unwholesome states not present, to prevent them. So really active in relation to states. And this teaching on the two kinds of thought does the same thing. He says, I was really active. I divided my thoughts into two classes. One was the wise intentions, renunciation, goodwill, harmlessness, and the other was there are harmful opposites. And then I really trained to notice that when there was an unwholesome one there that could lead to unwholesome action, when I reflected on it leading to unwholesome action, it went away. And this, you know, it's a parable, so this is overly simplistic. He might be saying, I had to reflect on the unwholesomeness of a certain thought pattern many times before it really subsided. But I think this is what we have to do. And when we do this, often it's not so simple as all that, right? I see that a certain thought pattern is unwholesome, but it's hard to stop. You know, it doesn't just go away. I'm like, thanks, Buddha. Oh, it just went away for you. Good for you, buddy. You know, mine don't go away so easily, right? I have to meet them again and again and again and again. I think that there's really, there's actually something very deep and complex and rich about this piece of practice where he's saying, when I reflected thus that a certain thought was unwholesome, right, that it could lead to harm for myself or others or both or non-wisdom or anguish or non-extinguishment. When I reflected on that, it went away. This implies that a couple of really wholesome qualities are already present in the mind. One of them is that the practitioner is pretty passionately committed to liberation. You really want to be free. Because if you don't really want to be free, then just indulging in your unwholesome thoughts is much easier, right? Being like, whatever. Ah, fuck it. Just, you know, let it go this time. I don't care, right? Sometimes it can even feel right to do that because the path is hard. And I don't want to work so hard all the time. And I want to just be like, it's all right. You let this one slide. And that's, you know, it's okay. It's okay. You get endless chances to figure this out. You've had, you know, innumerable rebirths. You might well have innumerable more. So, you know, there's always another chance to do this. But of course, if you keep spending all of your chances, soon death comes. You know the story. You run out of time to practice. So the one thing that's present, right, is a passion for awakening. The Pali term is samvega, intense determination. Another thing that's present is a strong, but part of what I hear when the Buddha's like, oh, this would lead to harm, and therefore it went away, or I was able to let it go, essentially, is a strong ethical commitment that's already there, right? Because also there's also a mind state that we can fall into that's like, okay, I see that this thought pattern leads to harm, you know, maybe for myself. Like maybe I'm like, okay, I don't want to hurt anybody else, so I'm not going to say anything about it. But I'm not going to mind very much if it's painful for myself. I'm like, whatever, I can deal. I'm not going to try to uproot this one, you know? Sometimes I even want to indulge in the hateful thought, you know? And part of what the Buddha is saying is, this is connected to the passion for awakening, that ethics, the sila, the keeping the precepts internally, not just externally, but really, you know, caring about causing harm to myself, causing anguish, and preventing freedom, this is also tremendously important. So it's tremendously important to wake up. That's the transcendent side. It's also tremendously important to not cause harm. That's the immanent side. And there has to be both, right? Sila, or the precepts, this is the relational aspect of the path. It's just as important as the transcendent liberative aspect. And they can't be separated. You can't be liberated while hurting other people. It doesn't happen. And you also you can't be liberated while you're still hurting other people, but also not hurting people, yourself included, is one of the strongest foundations that you can build for liberation to then, this is a mixed metaphor, take root, blossom. Because the surface level renunciation involved in being ethical, right, not causing harm to other beings, it's like a fractal. It's the same energy as the energy of awakening. If awakening is having fully uprooted the defilements, it's a way of saying, you know, I've completely let go of even the subtle tendency to cause harm to myself, even in the form of, you know, future rebirth. Like, I'm uprooting suffering completely. What a radical, non-harming kind of act to do. So awakening is like sila, or ethics, taken to the utmost. Not only am I restraining myself from speech and action and livelihoods that could cause harm to others, those around me, but I'm uprooting the causes of subtle suffering in myself forever. And so they work together. They're really the same energy. So renunciation and harmlessness completely work together. And then the bridge quality in the middle of them is goodwill, metta, loving kindness. And so these are the three wise intentions, or right intentions. And they all support each other, right? Loving kindness toward myself supports renunciation, because it helps me to let go of that which is harming me and support that which gives rise to well-being. Loving kindness supports harmlessness, of course, because it's one of the antidotes to hatred and ill will, which are the intention behind harmlessness, behind harmfulness, behind causing harm, right? Harmlessness supports loving kindness. Harmlessness supports renunciation. They're versions of each other. So the first half of the practice is how to deal with the unwholesome. So the Buddha does that first, right? That's usually how the practice works. Like, you have to deal with hindrances before you can fully get traction in supporting the wholesome. You really do both at the same time in a way, but, you know, you deal with the gross hindrances, and you swing back, and, you know, you get a little happiness. You deal with subtler hindrances, you get a little more happiness. You deal with even subtler hindrances, you get a little more happiness. So the Buddha deals with sensuality, maliciousness, and cruel thinking in a way that that causes them to be let go. So then it continues. So after those three, I gave up, got rid of, and eliminated any cruel thoughts, you know, sensual thoughts, malicious thoughts, that arose. Then, whatever a mendicant frequently thinks about and considers becomes their heart's inclination. This is one of the most famous lines, right? It gets quoted a lot in a variety of translations. Whatever you frequently reflect upon becomes the inclination of the heart or the mind. So repeated thinking of a certain thing tends to give rise to states that resonate with that thought. So repeatedly thinking hateful thoughts gives rise to hateful states. You know, that becomes the inclination of the heart. So if they often think about and consider sensual thoughts, they've given up the thought of renunciation to cultivate sensual thought. Their mind inclines to sensual thoughts. So, you know, part of what we have here is the sense that these two kinds of thinking are opposed, right? Sensual thoughts and thoughts of renunciation, malicious thoughts and thoughts of harmlessness. If you frequently cultivate malicious thoughts, you are not only habituating those states, but you're making it less likely that you're going to find states of harmlessness arising, right? If you, if you regularly cultivate cruel thoughts, it's less likely that thoughts of loving kindness will arise. And so, you know, we're really looking at how deeply habitual patterns of thinking are. And, you know, in a certain way, this is like basic cognitive behavioral therapy, right? You know, just train yourself to think these kinds of things because they tend to lead to these kinds of actions. And when you find these unhelpful thoughts coming, you know, interrupt them, intercept them, shift them around. So that's pretty basic. But there's really again, to tie it into liberation, the connection here is this line: whatever one frequently thinks about and considers becomes the inclination of the heart or the mind, both. There's a way that the process of slowly waking up or uprooting the defilements, becoming liberated, purifying the heart mind, all of those are synonyms. There's a way that this process can be thought of as, you know, and this is really how the gradual path is described, as creating a kind of momentum of goodness in your life. I want to create a momentum of goodness because the past has its own momentum. When I come into contact with the Dhamma, with good teachings, what I find is, you know, initially that they come together in a way to bring into the foreground of consciousness the states that I inhabit day to day, moment to moment. And I find out pretty soon, I can feel pretty soon, how my states are connected to my past, right? How they're connected to my childhood, how they're connected to my own actions, how they're connected to my intentions that preceded those actions. And so we have this connection made between intention or thinking, right? And before that, there's view, there's worldview that precedes even intention. So based on your worldview, there's patterns of thinking. Based on patterns of thinking, there are patterns of action. And based on patterns of action, the word for action is kamma or karma, right? Doing. Based on patterns of action, future conditions arise and future states arise. If I act in ways that cause harm, future states of remorse and regret are to be expected, right? Future states of fear of others. If I've harmed others, I will be afraid of retribution, revenge, you know, I'll be afraid of being harmed. The path to fearlessness is the path of harmlessness. And so the whole of the Eightfold Path describes a process where using intention and action as the building blocks, I bit by bit set up the conditions for a better future. While I'm doing that, I'm wearing down the results of the past. So when the past makes it known in the present as you know, as an obsessive kind of thought, you know, here's anxiety, here's depression, here's, you know, addictive thinking in some way, here's, you know, unwholesome sensuality, here's maliciousness, here's cruelty, you know, here's the defilements, greed, hatred, and delusion. These come from somewhere, right? And they come from a combination of my past and present conditions. And so, you know, the conditionality phrase, right? Because of that, this arises. Yeah. And so I see, oh, because of that, this arises. So here I am in the present, receiving, being pressed upon by the past and all those conditions. Everything I've done, everything everybody else has done, it's all pressing upon me. And I have these two things that I can do. I can diminish the unwholesome, right? So that's like working on the past. I can meet the energies that are coming into the body mind from the past, and I can work to settle them, to relax the body, to clear trauma from the body, to relax the mind, to clear old unhelpful patterns from the heart and the mind. That's the subtractive part, work on that. And then there's the additive part where I'm building the foundation for a better future. I have the intention to not cause harm in the present, so that in the future, more and more, no regrets, right? I have nothing causing tension in the future because I took care of my actions in the present. Being able to say, oh, I've dealt with my past. I've asked for forgiveness. I've come to resolution. I've resolved old hurts. And ever since I started, you know, really trying, I haven't caused further harm. This leads to a particular bliss called the bliss of blamelessness, right? You know, it's like you know you did your best and you've resolved the past, you've done your work as best you could, you know, and if someone has something more to clear with you, you're open, you're willing to clear it, right? You're willing to find forgiveness. I've dealt with the past. And then being not causing harm, and then, you know, having renunciation in relation to cruel thoughts, unskillful sensual thoughts. I'm not giving rise to the actions in the present that are going to cause harm for myself or others, and also are going to cause, you know, non-liberation in the future, right? So intention turns into ethics, and ethics becomes a foundation for meditation, right? For the heart mind to actually be able to settle into tranquility, because it's not tormented. And as the heart mind settles, I've let go of the past, and I'm able to bring to cessation the remaining tendencies toward further suffering. And so this is a long process, but it goes in spirals. We do the same thing over and over, right? Right. Clarify the view, deepen in the intention, in these three wise intentions, clarify my actions, repair ruptures that have happened so that the past doesn't follow me into the future. And then in meditation, right, even more subtly, set down the hindrances, give rise to the awakening factors, right? And every day, really, do the same thing, right? Set down the past, set down unskillful intentions, give rise to wholesome intentions, and take another step forward. So the Buddha does this, and so he does this for all of the qualities. You know, he diminishes the unwholesome qualities, and gives rise to wholesome qualities, and then he enters the path. And the way that he says it, that he gives this beautiful simile. So one more dip into the sutta. So here's the simile. Suppose it's the last month of summer, when all the crops have been gathered within a village, and a cowherd must take care of the cattle. While at the root of a tree or in the open, he need only be mindful that the cattle are there. In the same way, I needed only to be mindful that those things were there. All right, hang on. We have to do the first half of it. Back. Okay, so first, this is at the end of, like, they've dealt with the unwholesome. Sorry, here's the first half of the simile. Suppose it's the last month of the rainy season. The crops grow closely together, and a cowherd must take care of the cattle. He'd tap and poke them with his staff on this side and that to keep them in check. Why is that? For he sees that if they wander into the crops, he could be executed, imprisoned, fined, or condemned. Okay, I think that's a little harsh. But what he means is, when the thoughts are crowding in and they're unwholesome, you are very energetic. You stay very close to them, right? You keep a close watch so that they don't trample anything, right? You keep a close watch on your thoughts so that they don't become unskillful actions, trampling the crops. So that's the first half, right? Dealing with the unwholesome is like keeping a close watch on your cows when the crops are in the fields. But once you've dealt with your unwholesome thoughts and you have given rise to wholesome ones, then you don't have to work so hard. Then it's the last month of the summer when all the crops have been gathered within the village. There's nothing for the cows to trample, so the cowherd doesn't have to do anything. They just hang out at the root of a tree, and only needing to be mindful that the cattle are there. So once wholesome thoughts have been developed, you don't have to, you know, ride herd close on them, you know, poking them with your stick all the time. You can just rest back and know that they're there, right? Needing to diminish thought, like, you don't need to stop thinking. You need to stop unwholesome thinking. Once wholesome thinking is there, right, what are the thoughts that are present? They're thoughts of letting go, thoughts of loving kindness, thoughts of non-harming. These are among the most wholesome thoughts a human can have. And so they're not a problem. You just sit back under a tree. You sit back under a rose apple tree. You let them do their thing. They give rise to ethical states, and ethical states give rise to blissful meditation, and you're on your way. And so the discourse then launches into the meditative absorptions, and then, you know, toward full enlightenment. So that is two kinds of thought. Middle length discourse is 19. And we'll talk about it in more detail in the Sutta study class that's coming up. But we'll pause there for now.